I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Two former British cabinet ministers have accused Tony Blair's government of manipulating intelligence information to justify a war with Iraq. Robin Cook and Claire Short both resigned over Blair's decision to take Britain to war without the backing of the UN. Today, they testified before a parliamentary inquiry into how intelligence was used in the months before the war. We're joined now by Matthew Tempest, political correspondent for The Guardian newspaper of London. Hello, Matthew.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for joining us. Two ex-cabinet ministers testifying today, one of them Robin Cook, the former foreign secretary, which is roughly equivalent to Secretary of State here testifying. What did Robin Cook have to say?
He was very scathing about the government's evidence leading up to the conflict. He said many interesting things, but his most specific allegation was that the claim by the Prime Minister that Saddam Hussein presented a clear and serious threat was simply not justified. Now, Robin Cook had the same access as Britain's Foreign Secretary for 4 years to intelligence reports that the Prime Minister had, and he said there was nothing in those to suggest that Saddam Hussein would have either a nuclear weapon program or missiles capable of carrying WMD, and at best he would have some remaindered supplies of chemicals and biological substances which could not be delivered. So it was a direct rebuttal of what the Prime Minister claimed in the lead-up to the war.
So was Robin Cook saying that the Prime Minister spun or lied?
He was very careful to say neither and let the MPs who were questioning him make those accusations. He is still a loyal member of the government, even though he's left the cabinet. And because he's a lawyer by training, he's rather careful about how he phrases his answers. But that was the direct implication of what he was saying. There was no way around that. And his colleague, Claire Short, was more direct and more forthcoming. She's the International Development Secretary who resigned over the war, and she accused Prime Minister Blair point-blankly of an honourable deception. Now, and by that, she means that, in her opinion, the Prime Minister and President Bush came to a secret agreement last September at Camp David that Britain would go along with a US-led war, and that basically the entire UN diplomacy route was a smokescreen and, in her own words, a fig leaf for that. And therefore, when the Prime Minister came before Parliament and said that he was trying to work for peace, that, you know, he was committed to the UN route, that, in fact, she didn't use the word lie, but was a deception.
Now, how damaging is this to Tony Blair? Over in this country, also a lot of talk as to whether weapons of mass destruction in Iraq were sufficient to justify going to war. A lot of questions about it, yet President Bush's poll ratings remain well over 60%, as do Americans when asked the question, will it matter whether weapons of mass destruction are found or not? 60% plus of Americans say, no, it doesn't matter. How about in England?
Well, similarly over here, in theory, nothing could be more serious than a prime minister leading his country into war under false premises or a deception. However, there are difficulties. Although this has built up a big head of steam in the last month, there are problems in that the two main government critics, Robin Cook and Claire Short, who resigned from the government, don't get on. So they don't actually provide a united attack on Prime Minister Blair. And the other difficulty is the parliamentary opposition, the Conservative Party, were in favour of the war. So their attacks on whether the evidence was doctored or not are slightly muted because at the end of the day, they were in favour of the war, so it's difficult for them to criticise. But it's a very precarious situation for the Prime Minister.
Matthew Tempest, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks to you too.
Matthew Tempest is the political correspondent for The Guardian newspaper. He spoke to us from London.
This much is known. On the morning of March 23rd, 19-year-old Private Jessica Lynch and her Army maintenance unit were ambushed in southern Iraq. News reports said that Lynch fought her captors bravely, and a video showed her dramatic rescue. But a BBC documentary said the Pentagon staged that rescue. As television networks compete to tell the Jessica Lynch story, today's Washington Post tries to figure out what the true story is. Joining us on the line is Dana Priest, one of three journalists who wrote today's article. And Dana, at the very least, that day in Nasiriyah, when Lynch's maintenance unit fell behind the combat unit it was assisting, got lost and was ambushed, that day was horrific.
It was indeed, because many of them, as you know, were killed. But to set the scene, they were driving up to Nasiriyah. They made several wrong turns. in part because their own convoy ahead of them did not tell them to make a turn. They miscalculated other turns. The 18-vehicle convoy splits into three. The third one, the vehicle convoy that Jessica Lynch was in, is actually under attack quite heavily. It runs into a jackknife U.S. Army truck.
Not before being hit by a rocket-propelled grenade. The Army has done weeks of investigation. Your team also has done a huge investigation, tracking down Iraqis and Army officials who spoke anonymously. First of all, tell us some of the things that we heard about Lynch's heroism and rescue initially.
Well, the Washington Post reported on the very first day that she had been possibly stabbed and shot and that she had emptied her ammunition and perhaps killed some Iraqi soldiers. None of that now, we believe, is true. Those reports came from Iraqi informants on the ground working with the military and the CIA. They also came from some intercepted conversations between enemy Iraqi fighters.
What about Jessica's stay in the hospital? First of all, the lawyer who said he saw her being slapped in the hospital by a military person and that he went and helped the Americans find her.
That is probably the most difficult to still judge because our reporter in Iraq, Bill Booth, interviewed the head of the military hospital where she first was and then the civilian hospital. All of them say that she was cared for quite well, that she was given the best bed, that they splinted her arms and legs because the accident did cause many injuries to her bones. So they directly contradict what Mohammed, the lawyer, who now has a visa here, an amnesty, has said. And he has said that he saw some slapping. We know that military officials believe she was mistreated, but we don't know the extent of the mistreatment, and we won't know ever whether she was mistreated unless she decides to tell it and if she remembers
it. Well, both the Americans and Iraqis that you spoke with said the hospital was used by the Iraqi military for a staging area, but they'd apparently left the day before. The BBC documentary argues that the whole hospital rescue was staged for the cameras. What do you think?
Well, I think the BBC greatly overstretched what they actually knew about the situation. This was in hostile territory. It is very typical for the military to plan for the worst-case scenario. They did that by not only sending in the most elite and covert unit that they have, but also they went out of their way to send Marines somewhere else into Nasiriyah as a feint, as a diversion. That's quite an elaborate scheme if you're trying to do a setup. However, it fueled a lot of speculation because the military did not officially correct or elaborate on the situation of the raid and how much resistance they did not encounter.
Right. Well, Private Lynch is having a horrendous recovery, 67 days, I think, in the hospital, and you write that it takes her an hour now to move from her hospital bed to a chair at times. So it sounds, Dana, as if maybe this isn't the story that some of the networks are thinking they're going to get, but it's still a pretty incredible story.
I think so. And in no way diminishes what actually happened on the battlefield. I think we can trace that back to the fog of war, the fog of reporting in the midst of war.
Well, Dana, thank you.
Thank you.
Dana Priest, staff writer for The Washington Post. For more on today's story, go to our website, here-now.org.
Police in the nation of Georgia yesterday seized two containers the size of car batteries from the back of a taxi cab that contained a small amount of cesium-137 and strontium-90. And last Friday, Thai authorities captured as much as 66 pounds of cesium-137 from a man who hoped to sell it on the black market. Neither suspect has any known link to terrorism, but the fear that the radioactive material could be used for a dirty bomb haunts both incidents. Mark Gwazdecki is a spokesman for the International Atomic Energy Agency. He joins us from Vienna, Austria. Hi, Mark.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks, Mark. First and just briefly, a dirty bomb. How deadly and how damaging would, say, a few grams of cesium-137, for example, packed in a conventional dynamite bomb be?
It really is important to distinguish between a dirty bomb and a weapon of mass destruction. They are not the same thing. A dirty bomb has the potential to be a weapon of mass disruption, but the lethality of something as you described would be very, very, very limited and might not take any casualties at all. But nonetheless, we would have a fairly major decontamination job on our hands. And if it happened at the busy part of a city, you can imagine the economic disruption that it might cause.
Would certainly frighten a lot of people to death.
It certainly would.
Now, who's doing the smuggling so far as you know?
Well, our database suggests that in the great majority of these incidents, it involves opportunists or unsophisticated criminals motivated by the hope of profit. And in some cases, the theft is even incidental. They're really after a vehicle, and they end up with a vehicle with a load full of radiation detectors. So we don't see and haven't seen any individual case of a terrorist group bent on using this material to make a dirty bomb, but we certainly don't dismiss that possibility.
You mean someone stealing a car and it just happens to have this radioactive material in it? Is that what you mean?
That's correct.
Why would someone want to obtain this material except to use it for a dirty bomb?
Well, again, the cases that we've noticed in our database are, again, small-time crooks who think that there might be some money to be made. They see a radiation symbol. They think it's worth probably, in most cases, more, far more than it actually is worth. So in the majority of cases, they don't have a buyer in mind, but they're simply trying to peddle something and hope to make some money off it. We don't pretend that this is the total picture. You know, we don't know what we don't know is going on out there. And so we're saying that all countries need to do a better job and take a second look, not at every single radioactive source, because there are millions of them. And a smoke alarm isn't a threat to anybody. Sure, yes. From in medicine, in research, in construction, and any number of civilian areas, radioactive sources are used by the millions. Most people would be aware of radiotherapy units in hospitals where people receive cancer treatment.
And you mentioned smoke alarms?
A smoke alarm has a small amount of americium in it, and it's not a danger to anybody and certainly not a potential use for a terrorist. What we need to focus on are the most powerful of these sources, things like cobalt-60, strontium-90, cesium-137, and make sure we've got cradle-to-grave control of them.
Mark, the bottom line, if you will, is that for the foreseeable future, if someone wants to get a hold of this material, they will probably be able to.
For a determined crook or terrorist, indeed they could. I'm not saying that's likely to happen, but we're in an era now where even innocent things can be used against us. So we have to be even more vigilant. And again, it's not any individual group of countries. All countries need to do more when it comes to this sort of material.
Mark Gwazdecki, thank you very much for joining us.
You're most welcome. A pleasure talking to you.
Mark Gwazdecki is a spokesman for the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Just ahead, looking for a little friendly debate on the web? You might have to look pretty hard.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In the beginning, there were words. Before Netscape, before the World Wide Web, people were using the Internet to write to one another. Often they did it publicly, on bulletin boards, they called them. They formed groups with common interests, and they did what groups do. They talked, they shared, they formed factions, and then they fought, and they argued, and boy, did they argue. Well, a big part of the Internet is still about forming groups, but Here and Now's Internet commentator and philosopher David Weinberger says these groups seem to be getting nasty and angrier than ever before. So we want to know, what's changed? David joins us in the studio. Well, hi.
Hello.
Sorry, I thought I'd set the tone. Of some of these billboards, which really are just really mean-spirited. What's happened, David?
Well, that's a really good question. It does seem to me that these discussions are getting nastier. It's very hard to quantify this. I've checked around with a bunch of pals, mm-hmm. and they're saying the same thing. It is what had been pretty civil, occasionally heated discussions that may be going on for the course of years. Suddenly, it's name-calling, it's ultimatums, it's people stalking out in anger.
Remind people who maybe don't participate, what are these groups? What are they?
In many cases, they're mailing lists, which is just a group of people who have agreed that they will send each other mail. And so you send whatever on whatever topic. So if it's the Emily Dickinson mailing list, I send a message to the list.
I can't imagine the Emily Dickinson mailing list being too nasty, but I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, maybe not the best example. So you send a message to that mailing list. Everybody gets it. Everybody reads it. And they can respond to the entire list. And some of these lists have been in existence for 20 years.
Yeah. And as we said, maybe not on the Emily Dickinson one, but, you know, they're just getting, I don't know, nasty. Do you think that's because they're reflecting something in the larger society, or is it unique to the Internet? What are your thoughts?
Well, a lot of the discussions have turned to politics, even on lists like an Emily Dickinson mailing list. Suddenly they'll find themselves talking about the war in Iraq. It's often the focus. So the ones that I've been watching have become politicized, and the ones that were politicized have gotten venomous.
Well, these groups, do they monitor themselves? I mean, when you have discussion groups and chat rooms sometimes, well, for instance, here at our station, WBUR, there are chat rooms, and they're monitored by somebody who lets people know when the language is inappropriate. How do these groups function?
It's up to the group, and that's, in fact, one of the reasons why these arguments are significant, I think. Often these groups are self-organizing. It's a group of people who know one another one way or another, are interested in the same topic, and they do not sit down and specify a constitution and a set of rules ahead of time because they don't need it. It's just a bunch of people who are talking, and if something comes up, then they'll talk about it. But groups like those, which are very valuable groups and among my favorites, have an extraordinarily difficult time talking about what the group ought to be doing. It goes fine so long as it goes fine. And at the moment at which the conversation becomes, for example, so nasty that people start backing off and raising objections, then the discussion turns to the group itself. And the group doesn't have a way of talking about what the group ought to be doing. And there's nobody in charge to make a decision.
Which is why people are there in the first place, because that's the appeal of the Internet, isn't it? There's no policing and no monitoring in large part.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when suddenly you need one, there's no recourse and the group can fall apart. There's a famous law, Godwin's law, that says as an online discussion grows longer, the probability of a comparison involving Nazis or Hitler approaches certainty. And at that point, the discussion is pretty much over.
Right, because once you've called somebody Hitler-like, you know. And what happened? Do these groups fall apart when that happens?
Not infrequently. In one that I'm on, the moderator just turned off. There was a moderator. He turned off the group for a couple of days just so people wouldn't be able to escalate the verbal violence.
Mm. Well, what do you think? What do we know from this? Are these groups and the behavior of these groups any different from groups, you know, meeting every Friday night at the town hall to talk about something else?
Yeah, they are a little different. In many cases, these are people who have known each other virtually for years.
And virtually?
Only virtually, right? They've never met and never perhaps intend to meet. And there is some safety in that. No matter how angry you get online, you can't punch the other person in the nose. So it's a little easier to flame, to say things you would never, ever say in person. This is not the best thing about the Internet, but it is there. And so there's it's safer to be a jerk online, so these discussions can blow up more easily.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I mean, the great virtue of them is that you're able to meet people that you wouldn't meet in the town hall and carry on a conversation with somebody who doesn't maybe agree with you as much and has a very different perspective, perhaps because she's from another country.
Well, we've talked before about how the Internet always seems to create something new as a result of what the action on the Internet needs. You know, that's the nature of it. What do you think this will create?
I'm not seeing a lot of good coming out of this, at least not at the moment. And these have been civil discussions, one way or another, often rollicking, but mm-hmm. basically civil. And some of them are simply falling apart.
Yeah.
It's hard to know what the good side of that is.
Will these participants maybe migrate somewhere else? Do you see some other kind of exchange growing because the existing ones are having problems?
Well, there has been some studies of self-reinforcing groups on the net, because it's also a good place to find people who think exactly like you and to just chant in a mob-like sort of way. So what I sort of hope doesn't happen is that people leave these eclectic groups and regroup into little knots of people who think exactly alike. And I think that's the danger of this.
Yeah.
And the thing that most worries me, of course, is that this is, in fact, a reflection of the way borders are being drawn in the real world around issues of politics and government and culture.
Hmm. Well, David, since I'm sitting right across from you, I'm going to say thank you very much for informing us. We really appreciated that.
And I will respond just as civilly that I'm very glad to be here.
David Weinberger, Here and Now's Internet commentator and philosopher. For more, visit our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg on the 50th anniversary of his parents' execution and how he wants to help other children whose parents are accused falsely or not.
That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Maine wants to mandate health insurance for all.
A school committee woman in Massachusetts asks parents to donate their tax cut checks to cash-strapped schools.
And Capturing the Freedmans, the documentary that explores how a typical suburban family handled accusations of child molestation.
You know, in this family, the video camera literally had a seat at the table. You know, you start to realize that this crime has so totally overwhelmed the family, and you can judge for yourself because you're there.
Sex, lies, and videotapes coming up Here and Now. I'm Gina Cervetti. An American soldier is dead as a result of sniper fire in Iraq today. The U.S. military says it's interrogating Iraqis detained during a three-day sweep centered around Baghdad and northern Iraq. The soldier was shot as he rode in the backseat of a Humvee. He was a member of the 1st Armored Division's 1st Brigade. Negotiations continue in the Middle East as U.S. officials hope to get the roadmap to peace back on track. Assistant Secretary of State John Wolf met with Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas yesterday ahead of Abbas's meeting with Palestinian militants. Wolf says he wants to secure President Bush's vision of a two-state solution in the Middle East.
I'm here with my monitoring team. We will be expanding and working with the two parties to implement the commitments and to move forward to achieving the vision that the president set out.
The roadmap requires the Palestinians to end violence against Israel and Israel to end settlement activity in the West Bank and Gaza. The president of Liberia, Charles Taylor, has agreed to resign as part of a ceasefire agreement with rebels. Taylor has been at the center of West Africa's conflicts for 14 years. Also, he's been charged with war crimes in neighboring Sierra Leone. Rights groups say thousands of people have been killed and 2 million displaced during Liberia's civil war. An Arizona Catholic bishop who was charged with a hit-and-run car accident says he thought he'd hit a cat or dog, or that someone had thrown a rock at his window. Bishop Thomas O'Brien is free on bail and faces charges of leaving the scene of a fatal accident. Just 2 weeks ago, O'Brien relinquished some of his authority in an agreement that spared him from an indictment for protecting priests accused of child molestation. Former Rite Aid CEO Martin Grass has pleaded guilty to conspiracy charges in a deal that calls for an 8-year prison sentence. The plea bargain, outlined today by prosecutors, calls for guilty pleas to one count of conspiracy to defraud Rite Aid and its shareholders and one count of conspiracy to obstruct justice. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are narrowly higher. The Dow is up 9 points at 93.28. The Nasdaq is ahead 2 points at 16.69. And the S&P 500 is up 2. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Healthcare insurance, costly for many Americans and for millions of others, simply out of reach. The U.S. Census Bureau pegs the number of Americans without healthcare coverage at more than 41 million. But now one state has come up with a plan to cover the uninsured. The legislature in Maine has passed a bill that makes low-cost health insurance available for all Mainers by the year 2009. Maine Governor John Baldacci crafted the plan and will sign it into law next week. He joins us now on the line. Governor, thanks very much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Bill.
Thanks so much, Governor. Healthcare coverage for all Mainers. How does it work?
Well, what we've been able to do is probably particular to Maine is that each person recognizes that they're part of the problem. We need to change our ways and be part of the solution. So the best thing we can do in terms of bringing more insurance carriers is to make it more competitive. We've done this in other fields. When Maine had a similar crisis with workers' comp insurance, we created the Maine Employers Mutual Fund, which was a competitive state insurance program in workers' comp. It brought back the insurance carriers in a competitive marketplace. So we're using the same kind of tenets in the health insurance field. If we put 31,000 people in the marketplace at market rates, providers are going to get higher amounts of dollars, and insurance companies are going to have less bad debt and charity care. We want those savings to come back to help pay for the expansion of care.
Mm. Now, Governor, people who already have health insurance will keep their health insurance, right? This is about 180,000 people at the moment who don't have health insurance getting it.
Exactly. What we've done is done it a voluntary program. It expanded the MainCare program for people who were not eligible before. It sets up a voluntary health insurance program. It is going to be in a competitive marketplace, and it's also going to be able to work with health insurance carriers. They're going to be permitted to offer enrollees financial incentives. So even if they're in a separate plan, as long as they're qualified under Maine's overall program, they can receive subsidies for their own particular program at a particular business or if they want to do it individually.
So someone who was, say, out of work and had kids to support, how would they get health insurance?
They would be able to go to a state department and be able to fill out an application, and then they would hear directly from the health board where they would be able to make application and be qualified for health insurance.
Now, you say the program is voluntary. I'm a little confused by that. What do you mean?
People who want to be able to participate can contract with the state to do that. If you have a health insurance program or your company has one that's separate and apart, you don't need to be a part of this program. You'll actually get benefits because the 16% tax for bad debt and charity care will be reduced on your health insurance premium. So if I worked for a business that didn't want to get into this program at all, if they have workers that qualify, those workers can get individual policies. So I think it helps the small business because they can't afford the insurance premiums maybe under the regular program, but their workers would still be able to get individual coverage.
But if health insurance is extended to people who didn't have it before, isn't somebody going to have to pay more than they did before? There has been some criticism that it will, for example, raise premiums for people who already have health insurance.
Bad debt and charity cases that are piling up are being paid for by those that have insurance. So the best thing that we can do for those that have insurance is get more people into the marketplace. So we've gone through and analyzed actuaries, attorneys. I think the citizens have recognized that they need to take action. The thing that I'm proudest about is that we've got all the different stakeholders and interest groups to sign on to this, so everybody will be part of the ownership.
Governor John Baldacci, thank you so much for joining us on Here and Now.
All right, Bill, thank you.
Maine Governor John Baldacci, who crafted the state's universal health care bill.
The Gill Montague School District in Western Massachusetts is suffering. Class sizes are expanding, but a massive state budget shortfall is forcing 31 teacher layoffs, and language and arts classes are being cut from the curriculum altogether. All this as the Bush administration prepares to send a $400 per child tax credit to families around the country. Well, the irony of the situation has not escaped Gill Montague School Committee member Joyce Phillips. She's urging residents in her town and across the state to do what the state apparently cannot, use tax money to fund schools. Joining us from Western Massachusetts to talk about her proposal is Joyce Phillips. Welcome, Joyce.
Hi, Robin.
Well, what exactly are you proposing?
We are asking, or I am asking, actually, because I'm doing it as an individual and not as a school committee member, but asking my community members to really make some choices on real needs, that this $400 tax refund that they are receiving, to make a choice between paying bills, clothing children, putting food on the table, and making an effort to provide quality education. We have now a $600,000 cut, and this means that instead of the usual 50% that we receive in state aid, it's now a 60-40, with us looking for the 60%.
I'm sorry, what does that mean?
It means that of our budget that funds our education in our school district, 50% of the financial support comes from state aid. The other 50% comes from our taxes.
And that's been cut to 40% of state aid?
Yes.
Okay, well, so are you asking people to literally sign over their $400 checks?
What we are asking is to make a pledge and to commit to whether it's a part of that check or all of the check. They will receive a letter from the IRS telling them what they will be getting. When they receive this, we are asking them to make a pledge. Once they receive their checks, which will be the end of July, the early part of August, to submit those checks or those payments to the district.
Boy, Joyce, as you've already pointed out, you know, times are tough everywhere, and in Western Massachusetts as well, and you're asking people to make a choice.
We're asking people to make a choice, and actually we're trying to send a very strong message to the governor and to the legislatures and to the president, because either they're listening and they're ignoring us, or they're not listening. Because we're asking them, and we have been, because we, and I say across the state, in a Save Our Schools effort, have lobbied, gathered petitions, called, done virtual emails. Mm-hmm. And what our message is the federal and the state need to walk the talk of their political campaigns.
And in the meantime, what are you hearing from people?
It has been very positive. I have had a number of phone calls. We have had pledges made already. We've had people in the town who say, I'm not getting a tax refund, but I want to give something, and I am going to make a contribution. Mm. And they know that part of this is because an override for us is more money on property taxes, and we are a very poor, small, rural community.
Well, your plan for the tax cut, you know that this goes against the Bush administration thinking that people are going to get that $400 check and spend it on, you know, things like Barca loungers and jumpstart the economy. So you're in a small way sort of subverting the idea of the tax cut.
Not really, because what he wants to do is create jobs, and we would like to restore jobs. And when federal and state don't support and they reduce funding, when they eliminate or reduce grants, when they push unfunded mandates, this is a cause not just for our rural community, but across the state and across the country, because the educational programs and institutions are crumbling across the country.
Well, Joyce, thank you, and keep us posted.
I will, and thank you so much for inviting me to speak with you.
Joyce Phillips is on the school committee of the Gil Montague Regional School District in Western Massachusetts, and she's launching a personal campaign to pledge tax cut checks to support schools.
You're listening to Here and Now. The flea market in Gallup, New Mexico, fills the air with smells of Indian fry bread and sweetgrass, the voices of Navajos, Zunis, and Hopis, and the sounds of Navajo flutes. Producer Jordana Gustafson wandered the market and spoke with Varian, a Navajo flute maker.
Can you tell me a little bit about that, what you were playing?
It was basically a song that I made up for my grandfather, because he was the one who introduced me to the flute. And then I left, and when I came back, you know, he had passed away, so I kind of felt just cheated out that he wasn't there to teach me what I wanted to know after I came back, you know, so... That I kind of play, you know, for him. It kind of helps me feel that he's with me and that he's like, you know, like it's basically how the flute is projected as a wind talker. It centers myself back to my family and, you know, connect back to the earth. We take granted for everything that's around us and don't realize that we always, you know, need to center ourselves back to the earth. Even though we walk on it and play on it, you know, we don't think about doing that all the time.
How did you learn how to make the flutes?
Basically just through talking with a Lakota Indian elder. He never really showed me how to make them, but through word and, you know, my own artistic ability, then I decided to, you know, take on that role as a flute maker and flute player now.
So is flute playing and flute making a traditional Lakota thing?
It is probably in Lakota, you know, but I mean, I'm not Lakota, I'm Diné.
Diné is Navajo.
Yeah, well, Diné is the true word for the people. Navajo is a Spanish word which means knife.
So then, is this a traditional Diné thing?
For me, it is now because I'm doing it.
What kind of wood are they made out of?
I go with different kinds of wood, like from cherry to the ones that I have here are cedar. And I like to use mahogany, though, because it has a really deep sound to it. But right now I like cedar just because it looks pretty and it's easy to work with.
Do all of the flutes have four holes?
No, the ones that are small here have four holes. The bigger ones that I do make have six holes. That way you have more of a range in what you want to play.
What kind of a range is on them?
The thing is, with more traditional flute playing, it doesn't really matter, what key or what, because then if you try putting a certain key to it, then you're changing what native flute is supposed to be about. Just that you can create something by hand and by your own talent, what you feel and hear, and it's just personal, this is very personal.
It's not some specific mathematic.
No, it's not. It's just what you learn from your teacher and what you take into it. And like I said, there's things that I've changed since he showed me what to do. Well, I'm going to see if I can sell some things, but thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
Our visit to the Gallup, New Mexico flea market was produced by Jordana Gustafson. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Once upon a time, the Freedmans of Great Neck, Long Island seemed like a family straight out of a gentle, laugh-filled TV sitcom. Father Arnold, a beloved high school teacher, wife Elaine, the classic suburban mom, both raising three boisterous, rascally sons, Jesse, David, and Seth. A family like many in America that loved to take home movies of itself. Home movies that in the new documentary, Capturing the Freedmans, gradually and devastatingly begin to weave another tale of a family haunted by demons.
I don't think that just because there were things in his life that were private and secret and shameful, that means that the father who I knew and the things I knew about him were in any way not real.
That's Jesse Freedman, the youngest son, who would eventually go to prison, like his father, for sexually abusing children. Capturing the Freedmans is being shown in theaters around the country this summer, and director Andrew Jarecki is now in the studio to talk about his documentary. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Andrew, let's start at the beginning. How did you first learn about the Freedmans?
Well, I started out making a totally different film. I started out making a film about professional children's birthday party clowns in New York City, which is sort of an unlikely subject given where it went.
And that's, that must have been how you met David Freedman, one of the main characters, the oldest son in the Freedman's family.
Yeah, that's right. When David and I got together, it was because David is the number one birthday party clown in New York, and I was doing this story, which, was going to be kind of a quirky story. It wasn't going to be a straight story, but I thought he was an interesting character. And then the more time I spent with him, the more I realized that he was not telling me the full truth about his family. He was giving me these sort of very packaged, perfect stories. And knowing what I know about families, I thought that those were probably unreasonable. And then eventually I discovered that he had this secret story.
Police are charging that sexual abuse went on behind the doors of 17 Piccadilly Road in Great Neck.
We rang the doorbell. As soon as he realized who it was, he wasn't going to let us in, so one of the detectives broke the door down. And
the movie unfolds like one door opening after another door. As soon as you think you've reached a point where, okay, this is what this movie's about, it goes on to another level. How much more difficult was it that this is a story that unfolds, that doesn't have a strictly direct narrative line?
For some reason, I think it told itself in that way because I tried to make the film just as I had revealed information for myself. When I started investigating the story after I got to know David, I kept going from person to person who was involved and trying to understand what their version of the story was. And I found there were all these incredibly articulate, smart people, but nobody could agree on anything.
3 years it took you to make the movie.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you know at the beginning of the process, once you realized that there was much more to this story than a story about a clown entertaining kids in New York City, when did you realize that there was all this home video, both video and audio, that the Friedmans had taken of their own lives?
Well, at a certain point when I went back to David and I said, you know, you remember you said I was a smart guy, I could probably figure it out, but, you know, you didn't want to tell me this story about yourself. Well, I figured it out. You know, I had read about it at that point because I'd gone back and done Nexus searches and figured out that there was this incredibly salacious version of the events that was described in the media. And so I thought I should tell it. Eventually, when I went back to David and I described that to him, he said, all right, if you're really going to make this other movie, I guess I should tell you that in addition to the 25 hours of home movies of my family during happy times that my father took and I shared with you earlier, there's another 25 hours of home videos, which I started taking after the police showed up at my house.
It's not your fault. The police are railroading you. But it's not your fault.
Mommy doesn't believe it.
The police picked on you, and that's who they're going after. It's not because you deserved it. You're taking the blame.
How important was it having access to all that?
Well, it was critical in terms of how the film has ended up. You know, I had cut the movie before I had access to the home videos. I knew that there were some home videos. I had no idea how intimate they would be when I finally saw them. So I had expected to make the movie without, and it was fascinating without. And then, of course, when David showed me the first tape, which we called Jesse's Last Night, which is the night when, you know, they're three brothers and they stay up all night to say goodbye to the youngest one who's going to jail the next morning. I mean, it was so powerful. I knew that it would have to be a big part of the film.
What's today's date?
Today is the day before I went to jail.
Went to jail?
I'm going to jail.
Because we're watching it?
I'm going to be watching this after I'm already out of jail. After four and a half years because the case gets reopened. At this point in time, my life is as good as over. It is terminated at this point, only to resume at a later date.
A family in Great Neck, a New York suburb, a prosperous New York suburb. Are you trying to make a larger point about what can lie beneath the placid surface of a suburban community, a suburban family?
I think as I started to look at Great Neck as sort of this community, and then we went up in a helicopter over Great Neck to do these shots above from the air because it just seemed natural. I started to see Great Neck as this kind of big floating amoeba that was just sort of sitting in this soupy mass of Long Island Sound.
Yeah, and, kind of a peninsula sticks out into Long Island Sound.
Yeah, and then it started to look to me like, you know, just that the human organism that is Great Neck had sort of figured out that over there at 17 Piccadilly Road where the Friedmans lived, there was a bad cell. And in their view, I think they just decided this family needs to go.
Arnold Friedman was a pedophile, but the film leaves unclear just how much he molested kids.
Well, I think it does. I mean, I want to say one thing. For me, there is this crime at the center of the film. Sometimes the crime eats the discussion, and I think it's important just to say that for me, the story is about a family, and I try to stay focused on that. At the same time, you had to build all the information about the case because otherwise you don't know when you get into this family's home videos and you're sitting in the living room with them or you're sitting at the dinner table with them. You know, in this family, the video camera literally had a seat at the table at a number of dinners. You know, you start to realize that this crime has so totally overwhelmed the family, and you can judge for yourself because you're there.
Why don't you try once to be supportive of me?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because we all started at the beginning of this thing,
Well, let's start from right now.
Let's start from right now. We're all starting brand new. We have a decision-making process on the table. It's clear. Great. All the past mistakes, they were mistakes. We're not going to hold them against anyone.
Great. Now we're starting afresh.
Okay.
Incredible scenes in the film that the family filmed themselves of the family tearing itself apart over this crime, as you refer to it. He was a pedophile. He was into child pornography. And ultimately, he admitted that he had molested children in another part of Long Island.
Right. Well, we used to say about Arnold that we were editing the film when we were sort of half kidding. We used to say that Arnold was always sort of taking the position that indignantly he would say, I am being accused of the wrong felonies. You know, but the reality is that, that it does matter what he was being accused of, particularly in this case, because here you have his 17, 18-year-old son, you know,
Jesse.
who in this case went to jail for a very, very long time. And if you don't believe that Arnold was accused of the proper crimes, then there's no reason to believe that his son had anything to do with it. And that's a question that I think is raised for the audience.
Arnold went to jail for allegedly molesting many, many boys when he was teaching computer classes in his home. Right. That's what Jesse, his 18-year-old son, was eventually implicated in as well.
Yeah, well, I think there was a sense that, you know, whatever these two family members were doing, you know, they must have been doing it together. And what's unique here, you know, is that you have somebody who has such high stakes, you know, an 18-year-old kid who would have committed these crimes when he was 13, 14, 15 years old. And either you believe that he did these crimes at the behest of his awful father, which I think is perhaps an oversimplification, or you believe that that he didn't do these crimes. Either way, you have to have compassion for this boy and for this family.
How did the Friedmans react to this film, ultimately?
When the family saw the film, I think they liked it very much. They knew from the beginning that I was not going to make their version. They knew that I was going to listen closely to what everybody had to say. But by the time I got to change the film, I had done so much work, and I knew so much more about the case than even they did, that I think they welcomed the information and they welcomed the position of being able to gather that.
A Hall of Mirrors and a fascinating movie, Capturing the Friedmans. Andrew Jarecki, thanks very much for coming in and joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Jarecki is director of the new documentary, Capturing the Friedmans.
They're gonna put me in the movies. They're gonna make the big star out of me. We'll make the film about a man that's sad and lonely. And all I gotta do is act naturally.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
You can't never tell. The movie's gonna make me a big star.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink, technical computing software.